Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Transportation is often noted as the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. The built environment, offices, factories, homes, and hospitals, for example, are not far behind. Between the ecological footprint of construction, demolition, and the ongoing generation of heat and electricity used on a daily basis, it's no wonder, says Jeff Ranson of the Canadian Green Building Council. After all, we spend upwards of 90% of our time inside buildings, he notes. CAGBC, as it's known, is a membership-driven association of builders, architects, and green building advocates focused on improving industry standards, developing best design practices and guidelines, advocating for green building, and creating educational tools to support its members in implementing sustainable design and construction practices. Jeff Ranson, regional director for the Toronto chapter of CAGBC, recently spoke to a group of green industry leaders, explaining what the council does, the state of the green building construction industry, highlighting some of the reports that have come out recently, such as Making the Case for Building to Zero Carbon, and promoting the council's drive for Disclosure Challenge, which encourages developers to disclose building data on energy, water, and carbon consumption in order to demonstrate that transparency is a core value and a commitment to sustainability and continuous improvement, a good business practice.
So please join me in welcoming Jeff Ranson.
Who here is familiar with the Canada Green Building Council? Great, so a good number. We're a national nonprofit organization. We really have two primary roles. We're an industry association who represents professionals working in the green building space from basically every part of the building and real estate value chain. So property owners and managers, architects and engineers, contractors, product suppliers, you name it. And we're also an environmental NGO, so our mission is to improve building performance in Canada. So let's maybe talk a little bit about where we are today around green building and what's driving the development industry. So the first thing is, when you talk about green building is less and less sort of a subset of the building industry, and it's something that's really rolled into development everywhere. So it's not a separate thing. Green is integrating into the entire development market. So we really need to understand what are the major issues driving development in Ontario and the things that we're wrestling with. And I'll sort of say five big trends that we're tracking. One is the move towards zero carbon and climate change. The second is resilience. Very, very relevant today in Ontario, in all the markets, if you're in Ottawa or you're up in the Muskokas. We're seeing a lot of talk of climate resilience. Health and wellness is a major trend that's moving the market. When we look at the amount of money that we spend on healthcare, about 40 cents of every tax dollar we collect goes to health services, way more than infrastructure or anything else. Resource use is another big one. We're starting to hear a lot about the circular economy. These are things where cities are really getting on board, zero waste, getting rid of your straws. These are things that people are talking about that are getting mainstream attention. And the last thing I want to talk about is affordability. You can't talk about development in Ontario right now if you're not talking about affordability. Given that, I'll take you through some of the more traditional green building focus areas and loop back around with a bit of a maybe an escalator. I'm going to bounce a new idea off you all at the end, something I've been thinking about a little bit, about tying sustainability to affordability and how that connection is being made, and maybe not the way you think it is. And if you don't know what 80% below 1990 levels by 2050 means for a building, which nobody does, here's a really simple rule of thumb for you. This is what we're seeing internationally. through the IPCC, through Architecture 2030, ASHRAE, the American Institute of Architecture. All new buildings will need to be around zero carbon by 2030. Every building we build from 2030 forward will need to be there. We will need to reduce energy use from all the existing buildings by roughly half in total by 2050. And that remaining half of the energy we'll need to decarbonize. So low carbon renewable energy sources. That's your real goal. So that's the goal. So if you want to take all the complicated percentage better than by whatever, this is what the building sector needs to do to do its share, contribute its share to our overall goals. The good news is when they look at the available opportunities for carbon reduction, the building sector offers the most affordable strategies and opportunities to get there. This is not a technical challenge. We are not inventing technologies that don't exist, carbon capture and sequestration, you know, renewable energy technologies that we haven't quite thought of yet. These are tried and true, market-ready opportunities and technologies. A lot of it's just good design, good operational practices. These are things we can do today. So it's a challenge of scale. It's not really a technical challenge. Okay. So our impact on climate is about low-carbon buildings. The climate's impact on us is another consideration. So what we know is that the buildings we are building today are going to be operating in a much different environment than the one that we've been used to and that our historical data suggests we should be designing for. Our forecast for the years 2040 to 2050, we know peak temperatures are going to be much higher. You're going to have longer extended heat waves. You're going to have fewer rain events, but bigger rain events when they happen. That's kind of the general consensus. You know, this is real. So your buildings and the way they're designed and the systems they use are going to have to be able to accommodate that. That's some real implications for architecture. Health and wellness. So I mentioned this, 40 cents of every dollar goes to health services. This is our provincial budget. You know, we think about all the money we spend on stuff, roads and bridges and buildings and energy. And healthcare blows it away. If we can ever figure out how to get money from the health sector into wellness prevention, or it's health risk prevention, recognizing what's causing bad health, and a lot of that is, you know, the 90% of your life you spend inside buildings, you know, the opportunities are tremendous. And it's not just for the public sector. It's the private sector is recognizing this. This is a study that Jones Lang LaSalle, big commercial real estate advisory service company, put out. Just to give some context to stuff, your typical North American office building will spend $3 a square foot on your utility bills. So most green building, we're talking about energy efficiency, energy efficiency, energy efficiency. If you're a building owner or business, that's $3 a square foot is what that energy efficiency, you know, you're playing with. So you save 10% of that, great, save 30 cents. The building itself, that's your rent, gross rent area, $30 a square foot. So green building, you say, great, it's a nicer space, you know, maybe you're charging a rent premium, you're making 10% on your building value, great, you just made $3. The people you put inside that building cost you $300 a square foot. That's your salaries and payroll for those people. So if you're building buildings that are making your workers happier and more productive, that are keeping them longer, that's making it easier to recruit top talent, you know, you have a 10% improvement in that. It blows away your entire, you know, building budget, you know, and your utility budget. So we really have to look at the value of these buildings. We're seeing a lot of really interesting stuff around health and wellness and quality spaces. Waste is certainly a big issue, but one of the things we're really starting to build in the buildings sector is a life cycle lens for buildings. So we're starting to look more at all, not just the energy performance of the building once it's developed, but everything that went into the building. So the energy and the carbon, the environmental impacts of all of the materials and the construction processes that went into that building, and then, of course, what happens at the end of life and how is that material treated. Why that's significant, you know, we used to kind of ignore that. It was sort of a rounding error to the footprint of the building. But as we're moving towards more and more high-performance, environmentally friendly buildings, what we're finding is that over, a 50-year life of a building, with these low-carbon buildings, a third of the life cycle emissions are coming just from the materials and construction process. A third. So, we have less and less to play with on the operational performance side and much more opportunity to play on the construction processes and material selection. So we're seeing a lot of this talk in Ontario as well about particularly looking at structural components, the biggest parts of the building, the concrete and the steel with really high carbon footprints, and moving towards mass timber and alternative materials that have a lower environmental footprint. So this is really exciting in terms of density and new materials and new technologies. So let's have some big trends about what's going on in the market, where we're headed. I want to talk maybe about some more relevant programs and issues that you need to know about today. The biggest thing that we're seeing, what's driving this, and this is really the first stage to mass market transformation, is disclosure. Okay, this is before we even set performance targets. Measuring and understanding who's doing what is critical. And so we have a policy in place in Ontario, which many of you may not know about, but came into effect last summer, which is called Energy, Water Reporting, and Benchmarking for Large Buildings. It's a policy that the province put out through the Ministry of Energy, which requires, or will require when it's fully phased in, every privately owned building in Ontario, over 50,000 square feet, to report its energy, water, and greenhouse gas emissions annually to the province for public disclosure. So it's being rolled out over three phases. It started last summer for very large buildings, so 250,000 square foot and up commercial buildings and industrial buildings had to report last summer. The first year is a pilot year, so it's not disclosed in year one, but they'll report again this summer and it will become public. Also this summer, the threshold moves down to 100,000 square feet and includes multi-res. And then next summer, it goes down from 100 to 50,000 square feet, all building types. So we're looking at this. It represents about 18,000 buildings in Ontario. You're going to have to collect all of your utility data. If you have multiple tenants, you're going to have to collect utility data from all your tenants, aggregate them, report them, and you're going to get a score. So now, all of a sudden, your energy use intensity for your office building as a kilowatt hours per square foot will be published online. It could be used in maybe databases by leasing agents to compare different office buildings in the city, and you'd be able to say, where am I compared to my peers? It's going to be public knowledge. So we're starting to view disclosure as real. It will have certainly opportunities and potentially financial risk for companies who are looking to be competitive and to position themselves as top-tier properties within a marketplace. But we also find that it's a huge opportunity for driving performance. And markets have done this, and we're not the first. New York City's got one. Chicago's got one. Seattle's got a mandatory disclosure policy. In jurisdictions that have done this, they're seeing a 2 to 3% annual energy performance just through disclosure alone. This is without setting any targets. Once you start measuring this stuff, and you start looking at that distribution curve and say, why are we in the bottom 20th percentile? You start calling people and say, what the hell is going on with their building? Let's make it better. That's not acceptable. Building managers, can see how their building is doing to the building across the street, and they want to figure out what's going on and how do they do better. So disclosure is really important as a first piece to drive performance. So we're seeing this in Ontario. We're also seeing it voluntarily. We're involved in a project with three major property owners and managers. So Concert Properties, big rental apartment portfolio owner. Quadrail, which manages the portfolio for BC Pension Fund, BC IMC. And Triovest, another major property manager in Ontario, who are voluntarily disclosing their entire national portfolio. And the intent for them is a few, to show market leadership. They're showing all their buildings, good and bad. They're also starting to normalize the process of benchmarking, recognizing that what's happening in Ontario will probably happen nationally. And so they're trying to figure out how to get the kinks out of the process of benchmarking, set industry standards that could be applied by other jurisdictions that look at developing their own benchmarking protocols. So this is a program we launched this year. They're going to be publishing their information this spring, and then we'll be piloting this sort of voluntary disclosure challenge nationally for other property owners. There is a public sector one right now. So right now, all public buildings through the Ontario broader public sector are already reporting energy use annually, and it's a database, it's an Excel file you can download, and I know some people have plugged it into Tableau or different visualization tools to put it up online. So the assumption would be that every jurisdiction has a data you're going to start using. Disclosure isn't just about energy performance. Let's talk about resilience again. One of the biggest trends in the commercial investment industry is around climate risk disclosure. And we're just starting to wrap our heads around what this means. Ernst & Young did a big report to talk about different industries and how aware they are of the risks of climate change to their investment portfolios, and actually found that real estate is one of the biggest laggards in terms of disclosing climate risk, which seems strange because you kind of know where your buildings are. They're not going anywhere. So it's really an exercise of mapping and understanding local risks. As opposed to a lot of manufacturing industries, which are really focused on supply chain risk. So disruption to where the raw materials are coming from, or distribution or manufacturing. But this is happening. This has significant impacts. You can imagine if you have a portfolio of buildings, you know, and you've got a sales group that's looking at an acquisition in South Beach in Miami, or you're holding assets there, and the market's doing great in Miami right now. It is. And you look at the best case scenario flood map for Miami for 2030 to 2050, you know, that we keep everything below 1.5 degrees Celsius and we're doing great, that scenario map, most of South Beach is still underwater, right? So you bought a $4 million asset that is effectively going to be worthless. You know, that has significant impacts for portfolios. So that's what investors want to know. And the financial community, who has a fiduciary duty to disclose any material financial risk, is now being asked to wrap their heads around climate change and what that means for their portfolios. So we're seeing this. Okay. So those are so that's happening right now. This is where we're starting. So information is the starting point. Now let's talk a little bit about getting to zero carbon. And I said, I'm going to leave most of the technical stuff up to Emma. So carbon, what I did want to highlight, though, is that carbon is not energy, and we use those interchangeably a lot. The reality is that, you know, energy is how much energy your building uses, but different energy sources have significantly different carbon footprints. In particular on the electricity side. I mean, gas is the same carbon footprint wherever you burn it, but your electricity footprint is very dependent on the source of energy you use to generate electricity. And when we look nationally across Canada, the exact same building with the exact same energy performance can have a 36 times carbon difference depending on where it was built. So Quebec, their electricity is almost entirely hydroelectric. It is low carbon. It is effectively a carbon neutral building if you use electric heating. Versus, say, Alberta or Saskatchewan, where their electricity grid is almost entirely fossil fuel generated. In terms of priority, we see different design strategies being important depending on where you build. So the difference between a net zero energy building, especially from an economic basis, where you're saying, you know, our net utility bills are zero, may or may not have a carbon difference. And it's really hard in Ontario, where gas is so much cheaper than electricity, you know, to correlate net zero energy or net zero energy cost with net zero carbon. So this is something we're cracking. The first thing was really metrics. So 2 years ago, we developed the zero carbon building standard. It's really just a framework for measuring carbon at a building scale and assessing that. And it's applicable nationally. So carbon is the metric. We measure carbon from the building. There is a minimum energy performance requirement, so we do ask for a certain amount of energy efficiency. So you can't be in Quebec and just throw electric baseboards in and no insulation and say, well, you know, the grid's clean, we're good. It's not the most rigorous energy performance standard.
Yeah, but how is it different from LEED certification?
So, in a few ways. So LEED measures energy, until very recently, because it's a U.S. standard, on an energy cost basis. So when LEED says reduce your energy consumption by 30%, it's talking about your utility bills. So it works in the U.S. because their electricity is high carbon, almost nationally. right? So you reduce your energy cost, means you're reducing electricity, which means you're reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It didn't work very well in BC and Quebec. It doesn't really work well in Ontario. And because it's a US standard that we've brought up here, it's always been a problem. So it was a big motivation to create a standard that measures carbon. But the zero carbon standard also only measures carbon. So LEED also measures water efficiency, indoor air quality. Zero carbon standard does not do that. So you could do both. LEED is now moved and updated. There's a new version, 4.1. So 4.1 now splits the energy and environment credit in half, and half of it's for carbon, half of it's for energy cost savings now. So the first thing we're seeing when we start thinking about zero carbon cities is smart cities, big data, new technology, sensors, automation, electrification, district energy networks, district thermal grids, all that stuff's great. It's all really important. It's all going to help us reduce our energy and carbon footprint from our buildings by looking at the opportunities beyond the property lines, be able to share energy between units, optimize our systems, run everything more efficiently. That's great. But it's not just that. We need housing. This is going to loop it back to affordability. We know we need development. We're not building enough supply. There's some big demand issues and policy things we need to look at as well. But we need supply. We need housing supply for affordability. It's a social issue. But we can't just put it anywhere. This is the discussion we're having in Ontario right now. You know, we need cheap housing. Can we throw it on the green belt? We can't throw it on the green belt. I think everybody in this room recognizes the value of the green belt from a carbon perspective, from an economic perspective, from a natural heritage and recreation perspective. That's not an option. It's not a viable solution. It's not an economic solution either. This is the elephant in the room. When we talk about low-rise housing, when we talk about carbon, fastest growing emission sector in Ontario is transportation. It continues to be. Even with all the fuel efficiencies we're getting from cars, it's transportation. And so Building Green put out a study this year that looked at Energy Star certified office buildings in North America now have a lower carbon footprint than getting all the employees to and from those buildings. These are not net zero or net zero energy buildings, but if you build a new code-built building in Ontario today, your employee transportation is likely the biggest carbon footprint of that building. So where you put the buildings is now becoming more important than how you design the buildings. Code is taking care of the majority of it. Let's talk economics, though, right? So it's not just the carbon piece. When we look at the cost of servicing the different building typologies, so when we say, you know, building it in greenfield sites, because it's cheaper, it's not cheaper. Life cycle costs for low-rise development, in terms of the municipal burden on those properties, is significantly higher. And there's some real problems with the way we set up our fiscal policy in the cities. Things like property tax assessments. And it's particularly evident in big cities that have very different building typologies and property values. So, for example, if you live in Toronto in a $1 million home, that may be a 700-square-foot condominium downtown, or that may be a house on a 35-foot lot out in Etobicoke. Those properties are assessed at the same value. You will be paying the same property tax rate, but the cost to the municipality of servicing those low-rise residential homes is significantly higher. And our whole system around development charges and taxes is set up to encourage this kind of low-density, low-value development. So it's bad for transportation emissions, it's bad for land use and protecting our ecosystem services, it's bad from a municipal fiscal policy. So what do you want to do? Well, you want to leverage your existing infrastructure. And so when we look at your cities, we say, okay, great, we need more infill. We need more density where we already have capacity in our roads and our sewers. Except we have these things called detached residential only zones, the yellow belt. This is a term that's getting tossed around quite a bit. These are parts of the city that you cannot densify. You are not allowed to develop. You're not allowed to subdivide units, even if you don't change the building form or size or mass. And it represents about 60% of the land area of the city of Toronto, the yellow belt. This is places where we have existing infrastructure that you cannot touch. So what have we done? We are throwing all of our density. So we call it tall and sprawl. sprawls, we're throwing it on the edge of town with this greenfield. We're tall, we've picked a few designated growth centers where we're putting all of our density, which is why you're seeing in the downtown core, about 3% of the land area of the city is taking on the vast majority of the new development. And what happens when you concentrate all your development, well, I'll say this. If we did open up the yellow belt zone, we're talking all of the main avenues, if we allowed, as of right, six-story development in the city of Toronto along all avenues, you get 120,000 units of new housing. If you allowed for one extra unit within per hectare within the yellow belt, so that's one granny flat, one laneway house, one four-story home turned into a duplex, you get 20,000 units a year. One unit per hectare per year.
That's Toronto.
So expand that region. So huge potential to add new housing stock on existing infrastructure, leveraging that. This is tax product. This is another thing about existing infrastructure development. This sort of goes back. This is a group called Urban 3 out of the U.S. that does mapping of tax productivity. And they look at, typically, they do a lot of work in Rust Belt cities, and they look at old downtowns on a per hectare basis, how much property tax is being generated. And this is a pattern that repeats itself consistently. Downtown cores, high density living, are generating multiple times more tax value than the suburbs, even than the power centers and big box stores, for a fraction of the municipal investment in terms of infrastructure, transportation costs, services. So we're seeing this time and time again. 2 to 3 times the cost when you're building super tall buildings, just in construction costs, and this is a huge issue. And then land costs as well. What happens, because all the development's happening in 3% of the land area, every developer's grabbed that land, or they're sitting on it, waiting for somebody who's going to come along and build 30 stories, which is completely distorted land values. So we have a real issue when we concentrate all our density, when we disallow development everywhere, it becomes a land grab. We're forcing people into building high-rise to recoup their investments. High-rise is the most expensive form of redevelopment, and we're often even exceeding the existing infrastructure. So the idea, it's like, great, there's a subway station there. We need to put 30 stories there. It's like, you can't get on the subway at that station. So the fact that there's a subway station doesn't really matter. The fact that there's sewers there doesn't matter if you've got to rebuild the sewers. So we need to really look at where those opportunities, where we've underutilized the existing infrastructure, where there's spare capacity for roads, sewers, water, power, and focus development and allow, as of right, development pretty much everywhere. So got to look beyond the building. Sustainable cities are about more than technology. We need smart tech. Got to maximize existing infrastructure. It's the most cost-effective way to do it. Density is good, but more density isn't necessarily better. It's sort of the power of incremental growth in human scale, and we really need to systemically rethink all of our policies around zoning, around taxation and assessments, so that we are incentivizing the kind of development we want. So that's my rant. That's my answer.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening.